Now, the TSA here in the United States has kind of changed a little bit of what they were saying you couldn't carry on board. After 3 days of absolute bans on liquids and gels and lotion, you can now take non-prescription medicine, up to 4 ounces of non-prescription medicine on board. So if you've got little gel caps of NyQuil or something that you need to take on board, you can take that. Glucose gel for diabetics. Solid lipstick, as opposed, I guess, to gel lipstick. Baby food, now okay under the new list that the TSA issued late yesterday afternoon. For some perspective on this, I've invited Ron Suskind onto the show. He wrote a bestseller a few months ago called The 1% Doctrine, Deep Inside America's Pursuit of Its Enemies Since 9/11. Hi, Ron. Welcome to KMOX.
Paul, how are you?
I'm doing just fine.
Good to see you.
What lessons have we learned in the last 4 days?
Oh, gosh, all sorts of lessons. One is that human intelligence works, and it will be our salvation in this war on terror. That's what broke this case. A British Muslim citizen who heard something after the July bombings of last year that troubled him, and he came forward and approached British authorities. That started, essentially, an investigation that a year later saved arguably thousands of lives, many of them Americans. This is what will work. In this war on terror, we hear a lot about signal intelligence, meaning electronic surveillance, and not that that's not valuable. But ultimately, the key is going to be infiltrating these cells, having folks in the Muslim community feeling willing to approach us with pertinent information.
And you say in your piece in Time magazine that's out today called How to Stay One Step Ahead, you say that the United States would have more trouble getting those kind of things out of our Muslim community compared to the British Muslim community. Why?
No, well, I think that we're having more trouble. We know we're having more trouble. We are not able to have human intelligence victories for the most part. It's not just here, it's around the globe. One of the difficulties is that the United States' public posture, which is, you know, let's just say, so sort of confrontational in the minds of many Muslims, is one that is making us, let's just say, the last person they'd want to sit down with pertinent information, especially Muslims who may not like the way their religion has been hijacked, at least in the minds of many, by these radicals. The key is to present opportunity and preparation in a kind of match. We're not getting that information. We had some breaks in human intelligence, but the fact is we're going to need many more to prevent the next attack.
And the next attack, you know, people have been saying, we're coming up on the fifth anniversary of 9/11. It's been almost 5 years since we've had a major attack in this country. We really must be doing a great job against al-Qaeda. How do you read that?
Well, that's just that's exactly what they would want us to think. Inside of the U.S. government, that means the president, the vice president, the Oval Office, the Situation Room, the analysis is very, very different. And it has been for several years that al-Qaeda might not have even been trying to attack us. They tend to be very patient. They probably were essentially building energy and planning for some major attack. This may have been that attack, but the fact is that they think in years. We tend to think in news cycles, and I think they consider that patience not only a virtue but an advantage tactically. Here in this country, I think it's important that people not see the passing time without a major attack as a kind of proxy, a measurement of victory, because certainly no one sees it that way in the counterterrorism community, and al-Qaeda doesn't see it that way either.
There's a Pakistan connection, as Sheila McVicker just mentioned a moment ago, and there was one last year with the London subway bombers that isn't necessarily al-Qaeda connected. Could we be talking about Muslim extremist freelancers as our biggest problem?
Absolutely. You know, look, we have to abide by that ancient wisdom, know thine enemy. And what we're finding here is that al-Qaeda has embraced something of a franchisee model. Right now you've got cells around the world in havens. I mean, what's not a haven? London's a haven. Pakistan's a haven. I mean, obviously we don't want another haven in Iraq, but there are dozens around the world. And they tend to be self-supporting, self-sustaining. It's almost like children who grow up and know how to please a parent. They don't actually have to communicate or get financing from on high in Afghanistan or Pakistan, where bin Laden and Zawahiri are ostensibly hiding. And so that makes them hard to find. What we're seeing now, interestingly today, it seems as though someone from this cell may have gone to Pakistan in the past few weeks to get permission, essentially, as to time and place for this operation that was well underway. This has a precedent. This is precisely what happened in 2003 with this hydrogen cyanide attack in New York. One of the representatives of an Al Qaeda cell in America went to meet with Zawahiri, Bin Laden's number two, and Zawahiri essentially said, "It could mean a lot of deaths. It could mean great havoc, but an underground subway attack in New York simply is not a sufficient second wave." That's the belief of the U.S. government. He called it off. In this case, clearly it was not called off.
There was a lot of chatter, particularly in my email box over the weekend, because I was a critic of the NSA's domestic spying program. Not that I don't think we should be looking at bad guys, but the fact that they were broadening the net to include so much more in the hopes that they would catch bad guys. Several people wrote to me in the last few days, aren't you glad they are listening to phone calls? How much of that was a factor here?
Very, very little, in fact. This was old-fashioned spycraft, and very good spycraft by the Brits. It was human intelligence. Not only did they get that first break, which was a key, but then they moved very deliberatively, very shrewdly. They apparently implanted an MI5 agent inside of this cell, or certainly close enough to know everything pertinent. That had nothing to do with signal intelligence or chatter or the NSA style surveillance. Not that, again, it's not of no value. It is of value, but the fact is it was of no value for the most part in this one. We helped out a bit with some chatter late on in this proceeding. We might have heard something on chatter as to when the plot was coming due, but I think the Brits actually saw something even more important. They saw some members of the cell were vanishing. They were going dark, so-called, which is something that happens usually right before an operation comes to its fruition. That's what really meant that the trap had to be snapped.
Talking with Ron Susskind, author of The 1% Doctrine, Deep Inside America's Pursuit of Its Enemies Since 9/11, here on the Paul Harris Show on News Talk 1120 KMOX. The other day, the president said that this country is safer than it was prior to 9/11. What do you think?
I disagree with that, and I think the president probably should be a little more careful about some of the things he says in and around that. You know, the fact is, Paul, at this point, with what's happened in the world and with the United States' posture in so many conflicts, whether it's Afghanistan, Iraq, now Lebanon and Israel, and just our general position, we are essentially doing a kind of bring it on. The president, though, he says, I regret having said that about bring it on in terms of jihadists come to Iraq to fight us there. In a way, that's the message the United States is sending to an increasingly large sort of global community of disenfranchised and angry jihadists, many of whom are turning to violence. He's saying, bring it on. Bring it on in terms of attacking the United States, attacking the West. And I'm not sure if that's the kind of message you want to send out now, especially considering how vulnerable the homeland and our homeland security really is. I mean, anyone in the know who deals with those issues knows that certainly it's not all that we would hope and not all that it might be.
Do you think that's breeding new enemies?
There's no doubt we're breeding new enemies. I mean, there's no doubt that much of what we've done has created a set of recruitment posters that Al-Qaeda and other jihadists, other ardent Islamic fundamentalist terrorists could barely have imagined. You know, recruitment everywhere is up. There's no doubt about that. You know, from the time even of 9/11 or the London bombings in England, you know, a 2, 3, 4, a multiple of the number of active, potentially ready for operations jihadists. We're seeing that around the world. And what you see with this plot in London is that it had a kind of stripped-down elegance to it. You know, 24 ardent people with a good internet connection, they can manage a lot of that. These are off-the-shelf materials, easily findable in a world where so much can be bought. You know, click download with a manual attached. That's what we're facing now, and I think one of the problems with U.S. foreign policy is that the left hand and the right hand seem to be working at cross purposes. Some of our very demonstrative acts of tanks and troops and old style conflict seems to be undermining the new kind of conflict we're facing in terms of terrorists.
When you wrote the book, Ron, you got remarkable access to some really high level people in the administration and inside the Pentagon.
Yeah.
Have you talked to them in the last few days? And
no.
If so, what are they telling you?
Well, yeah, I talked to all of them. And, you know, what they're saying is, A, this sort of thing is the kind of thing that we were expecting in terms of a second wave. They're also increasingly concerned as to this sort of connective tissue theory of when Al-Qaeda or other terrorists will strike. And that's that they will tend to be activated with either sleeper cells or plans that are often long in the making, when the world is roiling, when there's a conflict that's exploding. For a long time, we were watching to see if one of these assassination attempts on Musharraf or Crown Prince Abdullah, now King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia, would be successful. The view was, had one of them succeeded, we would have almost certainly faced an attack in the United States. Well, some of that kind of a roiling globe connection of events theory, which is, I think, more than a theory, is what's making people quite concerned right now with what's happening in Lebanon and Israel. You know, a roiling globe encourages a terrorist or a terrorist group to say, we're part of that, we're driving this great historical conflict, and we'll show that by then attacking the United States to build a kind of synergy of turmoil, as they call it. That's why people are concerned right now.
It's funny you mentioned Israel and Lebanon, because my next question was going to be an email from a listener named Dan who said, is it possible that Al-Qaeda got jealous that Hezbollah was taking over the news?
Absolutely, and that's something that I've said to others. I think it's a sound line of analysis, is that there's a competition in the jihadist community. You know, clearly their thunder has been stolen a bit by what's happening in Lebanon by Hezbollah. There's no great love between Al-Qaeda and Hezbollah. They are adversaries going way back, but then again, you know, this healthy competition is not necessarily the thing that we want to see.
No.
You know, who can one-ups who else? That's, you know, for primacy in this sort of global struggle. You know, the better way to think about this, we think about a war on terror, it's really almost like a low-grade global insurgency. And there's a long history in the battles of powers, of even great powers, in fighting insurgencies. It's not very positive, that history. But there is a model there. I mean, Vietnam obviously was one for the United States. It didn't work out very well. But that's more the way I think the smartest people are thinking about what we're facing. And I think maybe, hopefully, that will evolve into strategies that are going to start to work.
You use the phrase war on terror, which has been really big for the last 5 years or so. Although the other day in President Bush's speech, he talked about this being a war against Islamic fascism. I'm glad to hear him using a phrase like that, and I wish we could actually call it what it truly is, because a war on terror, to me, is going to be no more effective than the war on drugs, the war on poverty, the war on other things, because you actually have to identify not the problem, but the enemy. What do you think?
Well, you know, Paul, great social movements are often determined by who seizes the lexicon and what words we use. It is important. And I think the original construction of the war on terror seemed to work in the first year after 9/11. But even then, at the very start, as I point out in the book, people are saying, well, what is the fight against? Terror is a tactic. It's not an ideology. It's not an enemy per se. And I think we're coming around, you know, maybe better late than never, but we're coming around to a better understanding of how to do this and do it right. Hopefully we are. That one of the difficulties is for a democracy, especially like ours, is to fight this a sort of conflict effectively in the political environment is quite partisan that we find ourselves in now. It's one in which you can't ever admit a mistake. That's not going to work when we have to improvise and change and deepen our understanding and maybe move in new directions so often in this new kind of war. And that's one of the difficulties we're finding. We need a political culture that allows for people to say, geez, I messed up. That's not what we thought, or the original strategy that seemed to work doesn't work now. We need to move in a new direction. I'm not sure if the president's going to be able to do that, whether or not he wants to, but that's one of the real challenges we face, because we need to do, I think, better than we're doing, and it's now during this so-called quieter period. There's probably going to be another attack in the United States. It's more a matter of when, not if, and now's the time to get our strategy sound. So that we're moving forward.
The book is called The 1% Doctrine, Deep Inside America's Pursuit of Its Enemies Since 9/11. Ron Suskind, thank you for your time and your expertise today.
Yeah, good luck to you, Paul. Thank you.
This is the Paul Harris Show on News Talk 1120 KMOX.